This is John Wright and Phil Marsh, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 19th of November 2011. John Wright and Phil Marsh.
It's actually Edward John Wright, but it's always John. Born 13th December 1952 in Birmingham.
So you're 59?
In about 2 weeks, yeah. 2 or 3 weeks, yeah.
Phil?
Phil Marsh, 10th of January 1951, from Oldham, Lancashire.
What happened? Why did you end up spending an entire winter underground in an Argentinian base called Belgrano?
Well, tell you, shall I start? And then you jump in. We'd been doing a geological season in the Shackleton Mountains. I was a GA. Phil was one of the geologists. The other GA was Doug Holden. And the other geologist was Pete Clarkson. We were using Belgrano as what you might call a forward operating base to refuel the Twin Otter, both on the way into the Shackletons and on the way out. We got airlifted out of the Shackletons to Belgrano, where we met up with another field party who were operating with the Twin Otter, which was the GeoSeaver project.
The same Twin Otter?
The same Twin Otter, yeah. So it ended up with seven of us at Belgrano who were scientists or support staff, plus the air crew, the pilot and the flight engineer, plus all our gear, all till we got back to Rothera to get the boat to go out. The weather was pretty poor, and we were hanging around waiting for good weather from Belgrano all the way across to Rothera, which obviously is quite a tall order. What's interesting is I remember everybody saying, "Oh, what a terrible base this is! Well, you know, it's mucky, it's old, it's crushed. Oh, I'm glad we don't live here.
Stay here."
Eventually, the weather cleared enough to get one flight away. I suppose there would have been the option of dumping all the scientific gear and the rocks and so on and taking everybody, but we decided no. Three of us would remain behind. That was Phil, Dog, and myself for a second flight.
Who decided?
It was decided between us, wasn't it?
Yeah, because Pete Clarkson was there, the pilot was involved in it. I think the issue was there wasn't really enough emergency gear on the aircraft for seven people.
Yeah.
It would have been four in a tent and cobbling together some extra food from whatever Belgrano could find in their store. That it was well more than a load. For what the aircraft was kitted for carrying.
Because we'd taken our field gear back to Halley in the interim. We'd been on just pop at the coast, dump all our field gear, the skidoos and everything at Halley. So we really were down to the Twin Otters emergency gear. Mm. You know, I hadn't remembered that. But the other thing was, Pete was married. The air crew obviously had to go. I guess there were two Americans, weren't there?
That was an international party to be.
There was an international party, so it seemed nice to keep them together. I don't think at that time there was really a big risk of getting left behind. So they went off, leaving the three of us behind.
And when did it begin to dawn upon you this was not a good idea?
Progressively.
Yeah.
I was to some extent forewarned before I even went to the Antarctic. I was talking to someone who'd wintered at Halley 2 or 3 years earlier, and I said, "Oh, I'm just going for a summer." And he said, "Things can change, you know." So there has been this little sort of, what's going on here? I think that as the various sort of plans were formed and not being able to follow through, I'm fairly pessimistic anyway, so I sort of work on the basis that this is something that is not going to happen unless we can make it happen, and as things go along, it wasn't happening. And I think people realised at different times what the situation was.
I think we started to get an inkling as well. When the first flight went, the weather turned bad at Rothera, and they couldn't get into the bluff either, and they ended up landing on Alexander Island. And the weather stayed bad, and I've got an idea they had about a 10-day layup with the aircraft on Alexander Island before they got a window and could hop onto Rothera. So effectively, it was a 10 or 11 day flight to Rothera on that occasion. You start to think at that stage in the season, well, if that's happened now, now they've got to Rothera, then they've got to get a good window to get all the way back here. Then we've got to get a really good window to get all the way back. it's starting to get a bit difficult.
When is it that time of the season? Where are we in the year?
Well, we got to Belgrano in end of February, was it? I can't remember.
Yes, it was into February.
February 78.
Yeah.
So by the time that that first flight had arrived at Rothera, it must have been well into probably March, because we were at Belgrano for a while. I could look up the dates at some point if you're interested and give you the
That's
dates.
End of the flying season.
And this is the crucial point. It was the end of the flying season. Do you want to go on from there?
So just the sort of progression. That there was possibilities of another aircraft coming to pick us up that was at Rothera, but the owners couldn't give permission for it. There was an attempt for us to be picked up by the Russians, who were just 40 miles down the coast,
yeah.
And did come and visit while we were there. I think there was a train of communications that went via Cambridge and London and Moscow and what have you. They came to Belgrano, and there was a sort of sitting around the table meeting. I had an interesting conversation with an East German who was with them, when we were in the Shackleton range, the Russian helicopter was going to a non-attack about 40 kilometres away that we couldn't have got to. And the East German came and said, I think the Russians would be very pleased to take you there, but their protocols are such that they can't offer. You have to ask. If you ask them, I think they'll say yes. So he was in the position, being a guest with them, that he could sort of be a bit of a go-between. And I'm not sure he didn't try and introduce that idea when they were at Belgrano. In retrospect, I think he might have been nudging, why didn't you ask them, to at least take you to Druzhny, which was 40 miles down the road. But I don't know about that.
Yeah, I'll just rewind a bit, because Phil mentioned another Twin Otter, the commercial one. There was actually the second Bass aircraft, of course, at Rothera. We were with Alpha Whiskey, which had inertial navigation, which was quite an advantage on a long flight like that. There was Alpha Papa at Rothera, but that didn't have such sophisticated systems, although it was certainly usable for the job, but they would have required a really good weather window. Keep coming back to that. But during this period at the end of the flying season, there was a big blow at Rothera. I think it was before Alpha Whiskey got back there. They decided to send Alpha Quebec North. And this was after... I got the sequence wrong. So Alpha Whiskey was there as well. On takeoff, Alpha Quebec damaged its undercarriage. The nosewheel went up through the cockpit. So it had to be taken out on the Bransfield. There was a aircraft operated by a commercial operator called Servair. I think Dog had it as Sunair. I'm 99% certain it was Servair, which was passing through Rothera. And its rudder was damaged in a blow. And they decided to... The pilots were in agreement that they should put Alpha Papa's rudder on the Servair Otter, enabling the Servair Otter to come over and collect as if there was a suitable weather window. That flight was... As far as the pilots were concerned, that was good to go. And actually, we did have some good weather. Mm. But the owners of Servair, the company, vetoed the flight, ostensibly for insurance purposes. Now, what's interesting is that 30 years on, I've got a buddy in Canada, in Ottawa, who I drink with, who was an avionics technician. And I found out very recently he worked for Servair. And as soon as I was recounting this experience, he said, that Antarctic contract they had... Yes, that's what caused them to go bust. And I wonder now whether, because the timings are so close, I just wonder whether the Servair knew they were at risk of going belly up, and that was the reason, you don't put your assets at risk when you're in that situation. So all the options for flying out are gone.
But there was still the option of the Russians collecting you by ship, and I understand there was a tantamount to an agreement that they would call in when passing and send a helicopter for you.
Was it an agreement?
There was ever an agreement.
No, I'm not convinced there was.
What do you think about
it? I don't think... partly because I've spoken to people in Cambridge afterwards, and this suggestion, completely separate from my conversation with the East German, was that I was told that they thought what was happening in the UK and Moscow was that the Russians weren't offering. They wanted to be asked, and London wasn't going to ask. But people along the line thought this was still a viable option. And my feeling is that certain possibilities were missed because they thought an option was there that actually wasn't there.
Who was not asking? Was this Dick Laws who was not asking?
The implication was it was the Foreign Office.
Right.
Mm. That was you know, the story from people
so
around was about.
Stiff upper lip, bowler hat.
Or whatever. I got it as a sort of, you know, bass gossip, if you like. So one can't.
It's
be
very
sure
hard to tell what the truth was. I mean, on a very local level, Dog was quite keen to go out with the Russians, and he was quite keen to push that line. We were quite. We felt that going out with the Russians was to an extent embarrassing, perhaps for Bass, and we would probably go along with that. You know, we were part of Bass, and it was a bit embarrassing to be going cap in hand and asking to go out with the Russians. And I think Phil and I at one point said, well, if they could just give us a lift up to Halley and drop us off there, so at least we'd be on home ground for the winter, that would probably do. And actually, thinking about it in hindsight, probably if we'd have said when we were at Drishnoi, because we visited them at Drishnoi, if we'd said, could you just hop us up the coast in one of your aeroplanes, they'd probably have done it. But the long and short of it was that whatever the reasons, we ended up getting stuck there. Was it you or Dog who actually saw the masts of the Russian ships go past?
It wasn't me.
No, it was Dog. I remember Dog saying, I've just seen some masts going past. And that was probably the Russians going north.
We'd had very good relations with the Russians during the end of the field season. They were in the Shackleton Range at the same time. We were on the radio to John and Pete Clarkson, and there was this noise over the tent. And I stuck my head out and said, oh, it's a biplane. And Dog said over the radio, oh, it's a biplane. Oh, it's the Russians, they've landed, we'll come get back to you. And they thought we were joking. But we'd had this sort of garbled conversation on the radio. Anyway, the story was, in the end, we camped together for a week and sort of looked at the rocks together and agreed things. And then we'd been to Drishnoi, and they'd brought the rocks back. Most of the rocks that season came out with the Russians, and that was a case of Pete Clarkson asking and saying, oh, you know, can we leave them with you at Drishnoi? And they said, oh yeah, we'll ship them back for you. So we had been talking to the Russians.
We got on extremely well with the Russians. I mean, after Phil and Dog came on the radio that night, Pete and I weren't all that far away, and we sledged over and joined them. And the Russians had got this sort of help. We were travelling relatively lightweight, you know, FID field units. The Russians had got a fairly heavyweight camp and were sort of blitzing a smaller area, and they'd just been dropped in for the summer. So we sledged over and we camped with you at the Russians' sort of field camp. And we had quite a party, didn't we? Mm. I mean, the Russians got fresh fruit and everything, and lots of vodka.
Lots of vodka.
We got on with them extremely well. So I'm being deliberately naive, but I don't think there was ever any malice in leaving us there. It was just circumstances, and at this stage, I don't think we'll ever find out exactly what the story was.
I was going to say, and as to the dawning realisation, when it did become clear that we were going to have to stay at Belgrano, the Argentinian who spoke best English and we spent a lot of time chatting to said, oh, it's okay, we had a meeting and discussed this yesterday. we've got plenty of, you know, food, and we can give you a clothing issue. Don't worry, you're welcome. So the base commander, who I think was a very sort of perceptive guy, had been watching this happening, and he'd been making his plans as well.
Famously, Fuchs apparently said he would have got you out. Is that
feasible? I'm... Sorry, Phil.
I don't know.
I'm not convinced. I'm really not convinced. I read Dog's article that he put in the Bass Journal. He quoted Bunny Fuchs as saying, I'd have got you out. But Bunny Fuchs by that time was retired. He was still around Bass. But if I want to be a bit cynical, and I'm not meaning to be unkind, he was in a situation where he could say that. Nobody would ever know.
It might have been a case of, it wouldn't have been like that in my day. It would have been another interpretation.
On the other hand, if you read Bunny Fuchs and the way he operated, I think it might have been, sorry lad, stiff up a lip, crack on. Because he'd had an enforced winter himself, I think, at Stonington. Was it Ray 80? I can't remember, but anyway.
So what was the basis on which you stayed then? Were you guests of the Argentinian government? Were you supernumeraries? Were you conscripted into the workforce?
We were supernumeraries.
That could have been difficult because it was Argentinian army. I don't fancy being conscripted.
The base was an army-run base, so all the sort of services were provided by the army, and there were civilian scientists and technicians. And it was ostensibly there to do science, and they were kitted up to do science.
And they were all staying for the winter?
And they were all staying for the winter. They'd had their relief, they were all staying for the winter. So we just became three extra hands. And for a lot of the work that goes on, I guess any base, but particularly that base, where there was a lot of sort of dog's body...
Manual labour to be done. Maintenance.
An extra three hands were an advantage rather than a disadvantage, I think. We sort of found our own little sort of niches.
On the other hand, I think to start with, particularly before it was confirmed that we were going to be staying, they were treating us very much as guests. Yeah. And we were sort of told, we've got to earn our keep. And when you're doing gas, or with your equivalent of it, or whatever it is, we'll help. You know, we can shovel snow with you. And say, oh, no. And it changed a little bit after we were definitely marooned. But it took a while to work our way in and to be accepted as... and eventually I think they realised where we could offer experience.
You had to get into the routine.
Yeah, I think it was one of these things where you had to be a bit diplomatic because they had different ways of doing some things. And sometimes one has to say they were pretty amateurish about it. But on occasions, you just had to say, no, button it, don't say anything, you know. But as we found our niches, I think that's the point. You used to work on the trineos on the sledges and things like that.
Woodworky type stuff.
I used to work on the mechanic side of things, and Dog used to work on
bits of sort of critical maintenance, like stopping leaks coming into the accommodation block.
Yeah, realigning the chimneys from the stove and things like that. So,
this base was underground, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very much like Halley. But whereas Halley gets about a metre of snow accumulation a year, Belgrano gets a matter of a few centimetres. So the base that was there had been there since the 1950s. But, of course, in that period of time, Halley had had three rebuilds. Belgrano had had none. So it was actually about the same depth as Halley, but it didn't have the advantage of being built in Armco tubes, as Halley was at that time. It had been built in trenches, which had just been roofed over with big beams and railway lines, which had stamped on them. Was it Wigan or Worthington 1912 or something like that? They were made.
Yeah,
but they were British railway lines used for reinforcing the roofs of the base. And
it had stood up very well.
Yeah,
considering how long it had been there. The design seemed to have worked. It's just that it was well beyond its design life.
So it was distorting, wasn't it?
It was distorting.
Oh, very badly.
Roof was collapsing. Unlike Halley, all the buildings were underground and were connected by tunnels underground. So you could move around between all the different scientific buildings without going onto the surface. But that did mean, because the ice very slowly, centimetres a month, moved in, there was a lot of cutting and carving to keep the passageways open.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was above the main accommodation block where everything was sort of sinking down.
Yeah, I mean, Halley, certainly in the Armco day, the core base was connected by Armco tunnels, but things like the Beastie, I think the Aurora were in different locations and things like that, so you're right, Phil. But at Belgrano, you could get to, I think, every part of the base.
You didn't need to go through a tunnel.
But these were winding tunnels that went all over the place and had to be kept cut open because otherwise they'd crush.
Where did you sleep?
There were two spare rooms in the accommodation block, one of which had a couple of bunk beds in it, one of which had a bed in it, and Dog had one, and we were shared the other one.
When we first arrived there, we were put up as guests, and Pete Clarkson and myself had two bunks in the major's room. And were you with Doc in a room?
No, I must have been in the one
You were in the one which I moved into eventually. Yeah. But just as a little aside, I remember seeing on the major's shelves in his bunk room his 9mm pistol with a full magazine of ammunition. So,
no, this is a military base.
Yeah. I don't think there were any implications at all with that. It's just that it was a military base and he had his sidearm in there.
I think some of the others were sharing, weren't they?
Yeah,
much the same setup as the rest of them.
But where it differed from Bass and from certainly from Halley at that time, maybe it's different now, but certainly at Halley at that time, the pit rooms were really for sleeping in. And certainly my pit room at Halley, it was a converted storeroom. It didn't matter because you slept in there and that was about it. Belgrano. I mean, we socialised in the bar or the smoker room or whatever at Halley. At Belgrano, there wasn't a bar in the same sense. There was just a dining hall, and people used to socialise in their pit rooms. Plus the fact there tended to be long siestas. Very often work would finish at midday, if it even started, and people would go and gonk until. Sorry, they'd go and have a kip until dinner time, or people would gather in a room and chat. And so it was very much living space, wasn't it, the pit rooms?
I think the short working day was partly the base commander realising that everyone was fed up there
with
the situation, and he just wanted to sort of keep it moving, keep people working, but not press anybody too hard if he didn't need to.
No. And I'll give the guys at Belgrano credit as well. Maybe it was the military environment, but when they were meant to be offered 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was, they were generally all there. It was very rare that nobody, because I suppose they did have a parade, effectively, that you turned up, and then the jobs were allocated and off you went. So I guess the bit of military discipline
goes to happen. Were you lining up on those parades then?
A slightly more ragged line.
Ragged line.
Everybody, just about the whole base, who wasn't actually doing something, the cook might have been in the kitchen, would be standing around the billiard table in the games rooming, in quotes, in full outdoor gear, because it was that sort of temperature in the games room. And the sort of command of attention, the military guys would, I think, stand to attention. But in these baggy windproofs, it wasn't very clear.
Yeah, it was a sort of shuffle.
We'd stop leaning against the wall and sort of stand up and look attentive, rather than actually standing to attention. And then the base commander would divvy up the jobs, and it was mechanics do mechanicking and people do whatever.
And he was divvying jobs to you as well?
Yeah. And
well, he often didn't need to, in as much as, for example, the mechanics went off and did their mechanicing. I'd slope off with the mechanics.
It was carrying on doing what you did. People knew what was going on. Yeah. But it was really a case of a formal get-together and everybody know what they were all doing.
How about the food?
Do you like meat?
We've both got pictures of the same plate of meat and two veg Argentinian star, which has got this sort of chunk of, I don't know what it was, beef.
There's a lot of beef, pork and
that's
mutton.
It's about the size of that of a pint glass. Mm. And then this little pile of sort of four peas in a sauce and a little green thing that you couldn't tell what it was, and a potato maybe. Yeah.
And lots of frozen meat.
Lots of frozen meat. It was a bit limited, but they had, it was okay. I mean, I think it was partly that it was the diet they had rather than any problem with what the stores were.
It was interesting because I remember asking Jorge on one occasion, is this a typical diet in Argentina? And he said, no, it's not. He said, we'd eat this amount of meat in Argentina, but at home we'd have a lot more vegetable with it. Mm. And that was the problem. There was loads of meat, but very short on the on the veg. I can't remember whether we used to take, because I remember used to have vitamin pills in our sledging rations. I don't know whether we calf-inched anything and took them. But
what was the hygiene standards like?
Not as good as...
Well, one went through the same mechanics as we're going to anywhere else. It's just that the facilities for doing it were somewhat limited. It was a shower, was it once a week, a shower?
Yeah, you were allowed a shower once a week, which is about the same as a Halley.
And it was done in sort of teams of two. I think we were a team, and one adjusted the temperature of the water in the melt tank by putting extra ice blocks in it if it was too hot and letting it settle down. And then, well, one had a shower, and then one switched around, and the other one adjusted the melt tank while the other one had a shower. because it needed to, the shower system needed one person managing it while the other person was showering. You were on the roof doing the water, so you were shouting through the floor.
Yeah, put some more blocks in, it's too hot, you know, or some days it would be freezing cold. But I remember the first time Dog had a shower there. He went for the shower, and he took all his clothes off and put them in a neat pile. And he stood under the shower, turned the shower on. Nothing came out of the shower as then, but a jet of water came out of the wall at the side, all over the clothes that he put in a pile.
Which probably froze.
Yeah. But the problem with the shower, you're saying about cleanliness, was that the area that we took the snow blocks from for the shower was immediately above the shower. Because we didn't go outside, we took them from the roof, didn't we?
A lot of them came from the roof.
From the roof space between the hut and the ceiling, and it helped keep the hut from getting crushed. But some time previous, a rubber fuel bladder had leaked on the surface. So all this diesel, we didn't use after at Belgrano, we used Arctic diesel, had spilt into the snow and permeated down. So you were loading blocks into the shower, which were permeated with diesel fuel. If you're lucky, you got a clean shower. If you were unlucky, you got a mixture of diesel and water pouring over you.
With everything, you know, I guess one, you know, whenever one lives, one can accumulate smells that one gets used to. I think everything smelt faintly of diesel.
Yeah.
And I've got one or two bits of gear that I've still got stuffed in plastic bags in the garage, and you open them up and think, oh, yeah, that's the smell of Belgrano.
Phil gets his fix every so often. He goes in the garage and sniffs his Belgrano gear.
But one or two of the other fits said that when they finally saw you when you were released from Belgrano, you were black.
Yeah. Pretty mucky. Yeah.
Everything was done by burning diesel in one way or another, and they had these drip feed oil burners, which were very smoky. But also, over the years, everything had got covered in smoke. So most of the work you were doing, you were handling with things that had got smoke on it. So we'd get, we were issued with Argentinian windproofs, which were just black, and which is what these guys would have seen as we got to the aircraft. We kept our own clean. So once we got to Halley, they were thrown away, and we were back into the FIDS gear.
I guess it's a bit like going back to the days of Scott, you know, and living with a penguin blubber stove or something like that. But yeah, we were pretty filthy. Mm. But Phil reminded me of one point, and that was the way that the base was heated. Outside our room was an oil-burning stove or a diesel-burning stove, and it was, I guess, 3 or 4 feet high. But the combustion chamber was basically a pan in the bottom of the stove, which was drip-fed with diesel, and it was just a flame in a radiator kind of thing. So this naked flame burning with drip-fed diesel, and the area around the stove, the floorboards, were impregnated with diesel. And these boards have been there 20, 30 years, whatever it was. And always in the back of our minds, I think, at Belgrano, I think on any Antarctic base, you're aware of fire. But at Belgrano, we were acutely aware of it, because if that stove had ever started to burn outside the stove, those boards would have just have gone up like a rocket.
I mean, fire is something that you sort of bear in mind, and it's a concern. It was so much of a concern that it just became part of you were just used to it. You couldn't worry about the fact that the place was a tinderbox. No. You couldn't do anything about it. You just had to be very much aware that there were naked flames everywhere and a lot of diesel.
Would getting out of the building have been simple?
No.
And also, where would you go?
Well, you could probably confine the fire to one block, and then there was but I'm not sure whether they must have had an emergency store somewhere.
If you could have got out of that bit, there were other places.
You could have wintered. Yeah,
you could have wintered. Yeah, it wouldn't have been a case of losing the lot. It was more a case of the immediate escape if there was a fire.
But there should have been. There was an access shaft at each end of the hut, but the one at the far end was completely blocked. And I don't know whether we ever. I think we made noises about
perhaps
opening
we really
it up.
To open it up.
But it was one of these diplomatic things where perhaps it would be a good idea if we thought about opening. And we tended to use the "we," you know. I don't think we need to worry about that. And I don't think it would have gone down well if we'd started digging it out. So you know,
how were you making these noises? How were you communicating? Because they presumably were Argentinian, therefore, did they have much English?
One or two of them did.
One guy had very good conversational English, and most of the technicians had some English. Actually, no, two or three of them had conversational English. And we started learning Spanish once we realised our predicament. And we're being helped by these guys. So in the end, we were getting on with a mixture of Spanish and English. At the table, we'd normally sit with the guys who wanted to practice their English for that meal, so we'd chat in English. But when we were working, we could well be with people who didn't speak English. So we'd get on with what Spanish we'd picked up.
And whenever there was a party, they were great ones for speeches. So we were expected to make speeches. And we got to the stage where I'm sure the grammar was absolutely appalling, but we could get by. Yeah, we could make a speech.
There was lots of cheers and applause after we'd finished.
Yes.
So, the context of the party was all that mattered.
Yeah.
So sociability wasn't a problem. There was never any tension.
There was, in as much as sometimes they do things, and most of them were quite inexperienced, but actually, having said that, for example, the principal is Sergeant Major. So the pecking order was, if you like, Base Commander, Major, Deputy Base Commander, Lieutenant, first among the men, the Sergeant Major. And he'd been south before, hadn't he? Mm. But he wasn't the brightest guy.
He was very grumpy and anti-English.
Very grumpy. Perhaps he was a bit anti-Brit, I don't know.
Well-liked by the men, though.
Yes, he was.
He was very well-liked.
And he came round as time went on. You know, when we left, I don't know whether we got a big hug off him, but certainly it was a very nice farewell and everything. But he wasn't very good at operating in that environment, was he? You know, you see him doing things. I'll give you an example. We had an airdrop. When things got really bad with the generators, eventually they did an airdrop. And Flacco, one of the mechanics, had been out there getting the pallets, which had been airdropped and things like that. And he came back into the base, and he got too cold. His hands had got, certainly on the borders, of frostbitten. They're certainly very badly nipped. And they started doing exactly the right thing. They put his hand under a running tap, warm water, just, you know, body heat. Principal came in, put his hand on the tap. Oh, no, turned up the temperature, hot water on Flacco's hands. Do you remember this? Flacco was in absolute agony. I mean, he was on his knees, in absolute agony. But, you know, just what you don't do. But because he was the principal.
He was the senior.
He was the senior. He was the principal. And, poor old Flacco was in agony with that. But we weren't in a... I think we probably said, no, that's not a good idea, but you can only go so far.
I have one memory of the principal. There weren't many auroras that winter. And there was one where the aurora men had said, come up, it's good. So the whole base went up, and there were some quite nice sort of curtains, sort of green curtains. And after about 20 minutes, it was a bit cold, and people drifted away. And the last two out were myself to sort of go down the shaft were myself and principal. And as we were about to go, suddenly these amazing coronas started, and it was like a fireworks display. So we stayed up for another 5 minutes or so. And when we got down there, he was enthusiastic and telling everybody and you know, pointing to me for corroboration. I'm pretty sure that had it not been us two, who were least likely to sort of collaborate on some wind-up, they'd have thought he was inventing it. But they had to believe him, because we were the two least likely to have agreed, you know, cook something up between us. Yeah. He was, we were sort of, you know, slapping each other on the back and saying, oh, brilliant.
I think it was part of just his character. He was grumpy. but I don't think there's anything wrong with the guy. He was fine.
You have an awful lot of time to fill, and you probably ran out of jobs quite quickly, I would have thought. So how were you passing your time? Were you doing geology, Phil?
I managed to practice adding about 2 hours sleeping onto the day.
We
got quite good at that. You have a siesta, that sort of passed a bit of time. I'd got my field notes. We hadn't got the rocks, but I got my field notes. So there was a few weeks' work going through those. Thinking through them, doing the things I would have done when I got back. So that was useful. When they had this airdrop, which the base commander had to negotiate for quite a long time to get, a message got through via Cambridge that it was going to happen, and the British Embassy in Buenos Aires put a box of books in. And they didn't know, you know, what we'd like. There was just this cardboard box, sort of wine box size, maybe slightly bigger than a wine case, packed with books. And it was a really good selection. There weren't very many that none of the three of us agreed. So that was quite good. I think we'd still got a few books left between us.
I think we had one or two books, but we rounded those pretty quickly. But that box of books from BA was a godsend. There's no question about that. And there was a basic Spanish course book in there, I remember. Yeah. And the other thing was we did used to go and sit with the guys, and I noticed in my diary I've got had Spanish lesson. Well, that was basically going and sitting with a couple of the lads and just trying to practice speaking Spanish. And drinking mate was a big thing, wasn't it? You know, Finns would have smoko. Well, mate was with this, you're probably aware of it, this tea which you drink from a gourd with a sort of a bombilla, a tube. And you put the herbs in it and you sit around drinking this and you pass it from one guy to the next and you put some more hot water in it and pass it round. And it's a very sociable thing. So we used to partake in that.
That often happened in the Radio Shack because that was the warmest place.
Because, well, yes, it was.
Properly heated.
Yeah.
Were there any competitive opportunities like chess or billiards or snooker? Or
table tennis and table football.
Yeah. And on sort of party nights, they'd play truco, which is a South American game. It's a sort of a cross between what? Poker and whist. I can't remember the rule. There are two sorts of plays. But the significant thing for a sort of military base is that cheating is allowed. Making signals to your partner is allowed, as long as they're the authorised signals. And that, you know, you sort of do a sort of wink, which means you've got a queen or something. And so some of these guys were very, very good at passing an expression without their face apparently moving. And I got partnered with the Principal in the tournament.
I don't recall playing that. I mean, I'm not really a card player. You were into that. And I do remember Phil playing. I remember we played table football and there was a league, you know, there was a competition. And there was a table tennis tournament as well. And I started off not too well in the table tennis tournament, but I managed to get through, and eventually I ended up in the final. And I was playing Hannibal. I don't know if you remember in the final. And he was a young army lieutenant. You know, I guess you call him a type personality. Pretty competitive. And I beat him. And he was very gracious. But boy, could you tell that he wasn't happy that he'd been beaten? I think we were playing for the Malvinas, actually.
Well, my next question was, did you ever discuss politics?
To an extent.
To an extent.
Yeah.
They at the time, they were more concerned with the relationships with Chile. They were thinking of having a war over the Beagle Channel. And in fact, I think they'd broken off diplomatic relations and things. And because it was a military base, the base commander had these sort of, I don't know, communiques, presumably, to repeat from his... And so at the parade in the morning, he'd very solemnly read out this statement in Spanish. And then he'd shrug and say, nothing will happen. we're still talking to them, we're still patting met to them. But I think we managed to educate them that the Falkland Islands were not populated by Spanish-speaking...
Yes, the level of ignorance
of South American
was absolutely astounding. Extraction. Literally, you'd say to the, you know, you'd start to talk about it and they'd say, yes, but the people are Spanish and they speak Spanish. No. And you say, honestly, you know, they don't speak Spanish. Oh. And so they really were quite surprised. And generally speaking, you aren't going to change their opinion. So you just agree to differ. There was one guy, and I was talking to Phil about it earlier, Raoul, who was a good lad. He was one of the beastie men, I think, wasn't he? And with him, though, it got to the stage where we just didn't talk about it because he could get quite animated about it. But most of the time, you just agreed to differ. What was more interesting, perhaps, was the issue of South Chile in the South Sandwich Islands.
Yes.
Where the Argentinians had put a base, which was actually only removed after the 82 conflict. And I think the Foreign Office knew it was there. But it was then that sort of stage where let's not do anything about it. But we used to hear, and they were just occasionally they didn't want us in the Radio Shack. Mm. And it was often when they didn't want us in the Radio Shack, you hear them calling Chile, 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 Chile. And you're thinking, okay.
Were you able to communicate with your families back home?
No.
No communication with Britain whatsoever.
There was the 200. Was it 200 words a month?
Well, they doubled it.
They did, didn't they?
And I was. I remember there was a. We were having a radio scale, I think, with Rotherham. The comms weren't very good. And I got, this was after it had been confirmed we were staying there, and it was, you know, all the static and things, and I forget who the rep was, but he said, yeah, I've got a message for you. Bass have agreed to double your... And I thought, salary! And I was, say again, your telex allowance. I think I'd rather have had the double salary.
So you were on Morse Rotter, were you?
No, it was voice. It was voice, but comms in that area are particularly difficult. In fact, it was far easier to communicate with Rotherer than Halley. And this has always been the case, trying to communicate with Halley, successful comms with Halley were the exception rather than the rules. We could normally get Rotherer, although sometimes there was a bit of frequency changing involved. And but no, we normally used to get air letters read out to us, and we used to tape them if we could, because the op tended to read them fairly quickly, so we'd tape, we managed to scratch a portable tape recorder, we'd tape them and transcribe them later.
The same as we'd had in the field, really.
Yeah, it was the same, really, no difference.
Dog seems to have had a really bad time, and you two are painting a much more cheerful picture of experience.
I think Dog had a girlfriend who, I mean, I think we all had girlfriends, didn't we? And he was very, very, very serious, and I guess I was, I'm not sure where you were. But he was very, very keen to get back for the girlfriend, and understandably. And I think we were a bit more philosophical about it. We were talking earlier on this afternoon and saying that, you know, there's no point in sweating stuff that you can't change. Mm. And it gets to the point where you've just got to make the best of it. And it's not to say you're enjoying it necessarily, although I think in many ways there are aspects of bugger on.
It's an interesting experience.
You know, would you, if you could do it again? Probably I wouldn't. But on the other hand, you know, life doesn't work like that, does it? It's, you know, it was a valuable experience. And there were good things about it.
I wouldn't have wintered. I think I'm probably the last. Oh,
were you?
I'm probably the last Bass geologist to winter. I think. I don't know whether any have done. Certainly, none did in the
you
next 10 years.
You weren't intending to winter.
I wasn't intending to winter. No, yeah. Geologists have stopped wintering at that point.
But I mean, from that point of view, you got a you know.
So I can tick
you could tick an Antarctic winter.
Your place in history.
No, I think yes, probably we did have a different view of it to Dog, and I think. Also, I don't know what your father's view was, but obviously people at home were concerned. And I think Dog's family were very keen to get him back. And my father still tells the story. In fact, he retold it yesterday about when this had been going on. And obviously he and my mother had been in contact with Bass every few days about what was going on. And Eric Salmon came on the phone to him on one occasion and said, Mr. Rowan, it was probably first name terms by then, knowing Dad, but I need to tell you that this and this and this. And Dad said, what you're saying is that he's not going to get out this winter. And Eric said, yes. Okay. Apparently Eric sort of said, well, thank heavens for that. He said, you understand the situation, Mr. Rowan? And Dad said, yeah, it's John's problem, you know. It's, you know. Whereas I think Eric had a bit of a hard time with Doc's parents.
Yeah, I think my father was much the same. He was he's gone off to do this.
He's a grown up if he goes and does these things. Well, you know. I think.
You know. So were you developing any sense of cabin fever? Were you desperate to get out towards the end of this?
Oh,
it was
about
8 months, wasn't it? You were there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder whether it was cabin fever. It's just time to get on and do something. You know, it's one of these things that if it wasn't interesting, it would have been just as interesting for less time.
Yes.
And it was a case of, right, let's get on and, you know, get on with life, get on with other things.
Yeah.
And that had sort of cut in before the opportunity to end it came in.
Yeah.
So as cabin fever as being sort of bottled up underground, not particularly. We'd go out, we'd probably go and...
We went out every day.
Yeah, and there were one or two guys on the base who you'd often see walking around, but some of them, I don't think they came up from one week to the next.
No.
There wasn't much to
but
see.
But that was the same with Halley. You know, there were one or two guys who would never go outside. Well, from the moment I arrived at Halley, I decided that I would be outside every day, no matter what. Sometimes it was for a walk around the top of the shaft if it was blown a hoolie. But and I think we adopted the same attitude at Belgrano, that we would go out every day. yes, would we like to have been able to travel? Yes, if we'd had a schooner, skidoo and a sledge unit, yeah, we'd have loved to have got out. Mm. But, I mean, Shackleton Base was just down the coast. That would have been a good tick. Yeah, we'd like to have gone back.
I'm probably accessible. I don't, yeah, there might have been big... Crevasses,
well,
I don't know.
Well, no, I think it was probably a feasible. I know the base was accessible because Jerry and Gary visited it.
Do you ever feel threatened or under pressure at all? Or?
No.
Not really under pressure.
Fearful for your lives?
Oh, gosh, no. I think we felt a bit sometimes. Oh, health and safety was different in those days anyway. But at Belgrano, it really was non-existent. And there were situations sometimes where things would be going on and you think, pardon my French, but you think this is bloody dangerous. Mm. You know, and I think I felt more, not threatened, but just, you know, very aware of the fact that you've got to be really careful with what you're doing here. Mm. Because some of the guys around you don't seem to be aware. But there was an incident, I don't know if you remember, pulling an antenna up the tower using a pulley, and Dog got his hand trapped. And the communicator, the hand signals broke down or something, and he got his hand quite badly bruised. I think it was Dog. Not in fear of your life, but just, you know, acutely aware that you need to be careful with what you're about.
How did you find out that you were going to be relieved?
Well, we were just picking up the general news whenever we spoke to Rothera. And I think at the end of the winter, we were also speaking to one of the other bases.
We were speaking to Sydney and occasionally Faraday. Mm,
we'd realised that we could hook our field radio, which we'd still got with us, up to the base antenna and a car battery, which gave us some extra channels, which were bass channels. And for a time, just as the ionospheric conditions were right, we could chat for a bit longer. So we were getting sort of a bit more news. But no, we were just getting the progress from Rothera on the ship. There was, I think the aircraft came more or less on schedule.
It did. They'd said right from the beginning, right, next year you will be the priority. Yeah. You know, the first thing the aircraft does. And we monitored the progress of the ship coming down. We monitored the progress of the aircraft coming down from... The aircraft used to go to Canada in those days for servicing, and they fly down through the Americas and... We monitor the aircraft.
I think it was just the same interest they have at Rothera when the aircraft are coming back. They were just passing it on to us so we could see. And then it came down to just the usual routine of waiting for the weather. The aircraft's there, we'll just need the weather to...
What I do remember is that there were quite bad sastrugi around the base. I know a twin otter will land on all sorts of stuff, but we wanted to make as good a runway as we could. And we got one of the snowcats because I was working with the mechanics. I was actually allowed to drive one of these things. I'm not sure whether you drove or not, but and we had some railway lines, very handy railway lines. So you can do lots of things from.
It's amazing how there are so many.
and railway lines and stuff, and big beams behind the snowcat. And I used to drive it up and down the airstrip, knocking the sastrugi down to try and make it a decent strip, and then you know. I think it was Giles who came for us.
Giles, yes, it was Giles. Yeah. Giles Kershaw,
yeah.
How did you feel then as you left? Were you sorry to get out or glad to get out? Or were you leaving behind people who became lifelong friends?
No, but perhaps I should have done. I don't know about you, Phil. I kept in touch with a few of the guys for a while. And then I lost my address book. And lost touch, and I was just saying to Mike Pinnock actually, because he still deals with the idea, look, if you can put the word around that those three stupid so-and-sos who got stuck with you, you know, 30 years ago, you know, we'd actually like to hear from you guys. It would be good.
Phil? Sorry to go?
No, not sorry to go. No,
definitely not.
And the thing I can remember most about going was getting to Halley and getting rid of this dirty gear and having a shower with clean water, putting on some clean clothes, some of which I've had with me all the time, and sitting down having a beer in the bar. That was when the transition had happened, I think.
And in a base where pride was taken over the base. You know,
So, no, it was just a case of, okay, that's it. Yeah, we'll go now.
You're making it all sound terribly matter-of-fact.
Well,
it wasn't really a big deal.
Well, I do remember Dog saying, we were literally in the aeroplane, we'd taken off, and Dog said, we're out. And I thought, yeah, I know what you mean. But I think my sense, and I actually remember this 30 years on, but I thought my sense of relief is different to yours somehow.
He's still angry, isn't he?
I haven't spoken to Doc for a long time, but I would guess he is. Yeah.
I don't think there have been times since when, work-wise, I can look at a period that long and think, well, fine, what happened then? You know, it was routine. I was obviously doing all the other things one does, but there was no particular... It was probably 9 months we were there, I think. That there's been plenty of other periods of 9 months when not a lot happened in the things that I was spending a lot of time doing. You know, obviously, there'd be holidays and things with family and things, but it was a sort of an experience that, you know, could have been 6 months rather than nine.
I think 6 weeks, actually.
Well, no, you wouldn't have got into it in 6 weeks. You know, we were on the Gash rotor, and you see the things, I think, yeah. I was just saying there about the Gash rotor, that they had a sort of a Gash rotor of these bases do, and for the first 3 or 4 months, the base commander wasn't in. We got put into it, but the base commander wasn't.
Yeah.
And then everybody was in towards the end. Did we just follow him, or I think we might have followed him. But he did a model Gash, and then the quality deteriorated. And partway through this, we were in it and had to feel we had to sort of up the standards a little bit, having had this example set. And if we'd been there 6 weeks, we wouldn't have got into that situation. We wouldn't have sort of settled into the base routine the way we did.
Final thought, really. When, 4 years later, when we went to war with Argentina against their military, what were your feelings at that point?
I think the first one would have been... To the UK Foreign Office, could have told you that. certainly, and Phil, jump in, but, you know, my feeling was that having lived with the Argentine army, I'd always got the impression that, no matter how friendly we were and so on, the Falklands were such an issue that if the Argentine army could ever do anything about it,
they would.
Mm-hmm. They would. Mm-hmm. And bear in mind, though, that this is only from Major... Lieutenant down the ranks, but and certainly Hannibal the lieutenant.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I could imagine
that being there,
Hannibal storming ashore. Yeah. But having said that, it doesn't stop. I still regard the guys at Belgrano as friends. You know, 30 years on, I haven't seen them, but yeah, love to have a beer with them.
And I think, you know, if Hannibal had been, you know, in the Falklands and had ended up in a prison somewhere temporarily. You'd have sort of thought it'd be nice to, you know, say hello to the guy and sort of, you know, say, you know, he was quite nice to us when we were his guests, as it were.
Yeah, I think in many ways, historically, ties between Argentina and Britain have been very strong, and there's only one real issue, and that's the Falklands. And in many ways, the Falklands War was an aberration. I know the President Premier keeps making noises, but the Premier of Argentina has to make noises about the Falklands. As far as... I mean, I was talking to Mike earlier on, I think throughout the conflict, the bases were talking to each other still and things were going on.
I think the perspective on the Falkland War was probably more influenced by being at Bass and generally with people who knew more about the geography and history than most of the other people in the UK did, rather than particularly the Belgrano incident. Mm. You know, it was the whole background that people who've been at Bass have got and been through the Falklands have got a better background on it.
And certainly from my point of view, having heard them from Belgrano talk to Southern Chile, for example, thinking, you know, the Falklands War needn't have happened if Britain had... You know, at the time, done a little bit more about it, perhaps, and said, "Hang on, this, you know, you're not playing cricket. You know, get rid of that base." But I'm convinced that if the Argentinians hadn't invaded the Falklands in 1982, they'd have had a presence there now. There would have been some sort of cooperative agreement.